Next session number 31048, reel 2.
All right. And various ones of people looking at maps and things. The Danish liberation of Copenhagen, because after the surrender of Montgomery, of the troops in Norway and Denmark, it looks mainly as if Cameron liberated Denmark, AFPU liberated Denmark, and we have pictures of my father in Denmark being greeted by a most attractive Danish radio personality called Greta Holmer, and was in Danish papers, which we've had subsequently translated. I think my mother was not overly impressed with that. No, keep that for a moment. And there, we now have the entry of the Allied forces into Berlin. The Russians, of course, took Berlin towards the end of April, beginning of May, and didn't allow the Allies in until the beginning of July, whilst they swept everything they wanted out of Berlin, from the university, any atomic secrets and anything like that. They swept Berlin clean before we got into it. And we've got a whole run of photographs here, some of which you may have seen or may not have seen. They will be in the archives, a lot of them, I'm sure. But here we have a Russian officer. And these were all well-dressed Russian officers. They weren't the fighting troops. They changed all the fighting troops over. Showing where they found Hitler's body outside his bunker. The Kaiser Wilhelm Church, which on the outside looks exactly the same now. The Germans maintain it in a state of bomb-damaged state, although the inside is very different. My father, who's a lifelong teetotaler, having been brought up in a pub, was forced to drink vodka with the Russians, and nobody argued with the Russians. There's another AFPU man, I think his name was Tanner, drinking this paint stripper of vodka with some Russians and being very jolly. The same here, a very nice picture of the Reichstag framed between a broken wall. A picture of my father, it isn't actually his photograph, but I like the setting of that, the way it's sort of done, and if you compare the Reichstag today, having been redone in the late 1990s. In Hitler's chancery, you have one of the chandeliers that came down with not a bit of crystal on it at all, all been looted, again in Hitler's chancery. Just general scenes there. And then the build-up to the Potsdam Conference. The Potsdam Conference was the last of the big three conferences, and Churchill was our Prime Minister to begin with, so out goes Churchill with Attlee as his deputy, as Attlee indeed was his deputy. Of course, halfway through, the results of our general election came through and Attlee became our Prime Minister and subsequently changed. So we have here all the general scenes of Anthony Eden arriving. The lead British division was the Desert Rats, and the photographs of various people of the Desert Rats, Churchill inspecting all the Guards of Honour, etc. And then we've got various photographs here. Truman arriving. He'd only been president since April, after Roosevelt's death. And for a man who come from mid-America to jump into that hot seat at that time, I admire what he achieved in the next few years, I really do. Portraits of Truman and Churchill, and I love that one of Churchill sitting in a jeep waiting to go on a cook's tour of Berlin, looking very pleased with himself, quite happy, and somebody's been polishing that jeep all night for him. Here we have three pictures. The Germans were made to come out and watch the British and the American and the Russian victory parades as they all took place on different days. And you will note that it is all women, children or old men. All the young men, of course, have been called up and were prisoners of war, mainly in Russia by that time. And there's the General Potsdam scene, etc. Here we have the British victory parade, 21st of July 1945 in Berlin. The troops taking part, and the order of march past the booklet, and it's autographed by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Fred Ramage, International Keystone. 6, Planet News, somebody else. 6, Fleet Street stroke photographers. And we move on to the last of the wartime ones. Again, they're of Berlin. We've got an awful lot of this. But the insignificant ones are sort of Churchill talking to Stalin, etc. There's Churchill's daughter, she came out as well. And of course, Attlee came back as Prime Minister. Churchill, Truman, Stalin. Just look at the size of them, some of his cigars. They were positively enormous. The American Victory Parade all lined up, ready to go. And then the pictures and the general scenes in the conference room. And I've put various names that I know or recognise there. I've only doodled these because our son has said, "Dad, if you don't write down, nobody else knows anything about it." And he's absolutely right.
How was your father operating in this sort of occasion? Was he?
He was part of the AFPU. He was one of the two still photographers covering the Potsdam Conference. And I've got a picture of the press corps. The press corps is very tiny when you think of the press corps now for anything that takes place. Here we have a picture which is of the big three sitting in their chairs. Stalin, Truman, well, that one is of Churchill. And when they got up and sort of exhausted the photographer's patience, the photographers jumped down and sat in their chairs and had themselves photographed as the new big three. That was Lockyer, who was the AFPU other photographer, and that one, I did find out the name the other day. I can't think of the name. So
you perhaps have the sense that it was all serious business, but you get flashes where they were obviously really keen on the jokes and the pranks. And
that's an interesting little thing. You don't often have a telephone directory that's sort of stuffed in with a load of photographs. It's the British delegation to the Potsdam Conference, and if you go to page 9, you'll find my father's telephone number. Well, one of the things that took place when they were in Berlin was that they were in the German Chancery. And my father and Jimmy Jarshi, his old mate from Fleet Street, who was older than my father probably sort of followed Jimmy through Fleet Street, about 10 years behind Jimmy Jarshi. And they were very close mates and good friends. And they awarded themselves all these medals from Hitler's Chancery, the medal room they let themselves into. I mean, that one was the Silver Mutter Medal for having 5 medals for the Führer, 5 children for the Führer, and that one's the Gold Mutter Medal for having 10 children for the Führer. You blink, don't you? All those medals my father had, he brought home. We know they were there about for 1980 when my mother moved. And when my mother died, we don't know what happened.
How do you know some of those are worth £20,000?
Because we've had somebody who's an expert on this sort of thing. And there's what I think is a lovely smug picture of two photographers enjoying victory in Europe. Now, that won't be in your museum. That is, I think that's an illustrated copyright. But and at the same time, my father, I was at boarding school in North Wales at that time, and I started getting letters on Adolf Hitler notepaper with the full Chancery address, Chancery of the Führers, Führer, leader of the NSDAP, which is the Nazi Party, typed on a German typewriter, not very well. Remember, the keyboard on a German typewriter is not a QWERTY board, as we know. It goes the German way round. We're living in France now, and a French keyboard is another way round as well. So I was the only boy at school getting letters on Adolf Hitler notepaper. We didn't bring them with us. Those are photocopies that I've got here today, and I have one blank sheet. Well, good quality paper, isn't it?
Brilliant.
It's good rag paper. And here we have war correspondents, photographers pass. The Russian pass for Potsdam. And there's the press corps for Potsdam. All three nations, not a lot. pretty small really when you compare it to what you will see today. He was mentioned in dispatches after the war. He told me that he was offered something, sort of a medal of some sort, and he said it was no use to him in Fleet Street. Give it to somebody where it would be of use. And I believe he said it went to somebody who was a town clerk or something, because it would, you know, have letters after your name would be a lot better for a town clerk. After the war, he came out in September, or late August, September 1945, because being one of the first in, he was one of the first out.
And why was he one of the first in? Because he didn't say
that. No. He volunteered because he in 1939, because he took the view that he was going to be conscripted because he was of the age. And if you volunteered, you got twice the money of a conscripted man. Having a wife, a child and a mortgage, he thought it was a better deal to volunteer. Now, he told me that originally he was destined for the Royal Air Force. Now, what happened to that, I know not. And I don't think he ever even got a uniform or anything. And he finished up, as we said earlier, going to in the army to with the BEF in 1940.
That was as a photographer?
As a photographer, AFPU was not in existence in those days. And I can remember him in probably 42, 43, being stationed in Sloane Square. Now, what was in Sloane Square in those days, I don't know, because we used to go up, and I'm talking about we as my mother and I, we would go up and we'd have lunch in Harrods. I can remember that quite clearly, and go to Peter Jones at the other end of Sloane Street. I can remember that quite clearly. Whether it was AFPU there or whether it was the what he was working with originally, I know not. Anyway, after the war, he went back to Illustrated.
Yeah.
No, we have no pictures of Belson at home. He never brought them home. The only pictures he never brought home. We have culled. I have to say we. My mother mainly has culled mountains of photographs that he brought home. But he never brought anything of Belson. Never spoke of it. I don't even think to my mother. Although he did autograph various books that came out in the 50s, pictures of the Second World War, any that were his, of which the Belson Death Pit one was autographed. But he wouldn't talk about it. And I think I can understand why. Having seen your set of pictures now, I had to see the whole set by coming here a couple of years ago. And the only comment he made to me was, I don't know when it was, I made some comment about the Germans and concentration camps, etc., etc. And he said to me, never blame the Germans as a race. I know a lot of English people, given similar circumstances, who have acted in a similar way. Which is an interesting, rather sage comment when you think what's happened in the Balkans in the last 15, 20 years, which is basically the self-same thing. Now I look back, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, you can see that's quite a sage comment.
What effect did you find, or did he describe that the war had on him, both sort of personally and on his work?
It aged him quite considerably. I mean, certainly he came back with grey hair, a very tired person. I mean, Hilary dug out a photograph of him, 1944 I think it was, and if you compare that with 1939, it's not just 4 or 5 years, it's quite a considerable thing. I think it's very difficult to be exactly precise, because I don't think, like so many people of that age, they were doing a job. And his job was to photograph things, not necessarily to be part of that photograph, of that history. And Linda has a term that he walked with history, which he very much did walk with history. But didn't know it and wouldn't be deeply appreciative of it, because he wasn't interested, like I am, in history. And therefore, And he wanted to maintain for us the best of things for my mother and me and our house, which had been partially bombed during the war by V1. And after the war, he wanted to ensure that we had holidays. We went to Ireland in 1946, of all places, because it was the only country where you could get a good meal without travelling through horrendous damage. Because Ireland, Southern Ireland, hadn't been in the war. And then after, in 48, 49, I was very lucky. We went on holidays to Europe, to Switzerland, and places where there was nothing that was nasty, or remnants of the war. He spent so much time after the war going to Germany, going to Europe, full stop. I would say reliving the war, but seeing the effects of the war with what then was known as the DPs, the displaced persons. Although I think that did have a deep effect in the fact he wanted to ensure it didn't occur for himself. That answers.
Well, I also think that he was competitive.
Oh, yes.
And he had to be in Fleet Street. And I think he would have always wanted his photographs to be the best that he could do.
Yes.
I think that's important.
Fleet Street is terrible, is by nature competitive. I mean, a lot of that competition now has gone because of the speed that you can transmit it from Afghanistan onto Hillary's desk. But nevertheless, if you've got something that's worth it, you want to be the first in the press.
The story of how he used to get it back.
Yeah, I mean, in any stories that he covered in East Anglia with the press pack in the 20s and 30s, he could always get it back into Fleet Street and in the evening papers before anybody else, because he knew all the cuts and by-cuts through the East End of London to get into Fleet Street until they stuck on his tail and followed him through. How the hell was Melly getting back before anybody else? So from that point of view, that's the competitive nature. And certainly people like Bert Hardy and he were very competitive and would look at each other's photographs, whether they were in Picture Post or Illustrated. And, you know, of course, Bert's got a good story on this week in Sounds. I've got some lovely pictures. So it was that awareness of other people's work. So after the war, he went back to Illustrated. Well, back to Illustrated. He went to Illustrated, moving away from the hurly-burly of the daily press. He was moving away from that in 1938-39 anyway. It's a very tiring, hard life, racing around as it was in those days, and get back with your plates to Fleet Street, etc., etc. And he was moving away to the composition of a photographic story. He went back to Vargso in 1946, I think 46 he went back to Vargso, and retook photographs in Vargso, like the ones that we've just seen, taken from the same angle, what they're like today. 5 years later, I came back. They're all published in Illustrated. And then in 1947, he did a series of pictures of an open heart operation. Now, we sort of say that now in 2008, sort of, an open heart operation. But in 1947-48, it was serious upfront surgery. And this was a boy, a blue baby. You don't hear much about blue babies now. When I was a kid, you did. These had heart problems, heart defects. And he went in, he did this whole story on this boy before, during the operation, and after the recuperation, and how he could run up and downstairs instead of being carried up and downstairs by his father. And the surgeon holding the boy's heart in his hand, saying, "Do you want to photograph that?" You know. And he won the Encyclopaedia Britannica Award for the sequence of pictures for 1948, I think, 1947-48. And carried on doing a lot of work for Illustrated, both black and white and colour. Colour, I don't think he was so happy with. Colour was never so true for him. And we went together, the King's Lying in State, in 1951, to Westminster Hall. I went with him, and we did Queen Mary the following year. Absolutely stunning and moving, wonderful, wonderful things. And we've got a series of pictures here which come from his illustrated days in, well, subsequently. An unusual photograph of the Queen looking incredibly happy, doing what she enjoys most, which is horse racing. Relaxed, absolutely happy, lovely pictures. And then we have the old man himself in Chartwell, 1951-53. He was back as Prime Minister. That, I'm told by our grandson, is hanging in his study in Chartwell. And it's been confirmed by an Australian guest we had at our Chambre d'Hôte last year. And the same shoot, we have Churchill on the pink terrace at Chartwell with family. Randolph, Duncan Sands, his son-in-law, and various grandchildren.
My father was very laid back about photographing anybody from the royal family.
Well, they're just a list.
Yeah, absolutely.
We do have a list, I think you produced it in there, didn't you, of all the various royals that he has had photographed, or significant people that we know that he's photographed. Took it to King Paul of Yugoslavia when he arrived in London in 1941, and that was it, you know.
He, from these anyway, he seems to favour a more informal and relaxed.
Yes. Use of light and dark, which is something which was my father's keystone, as I said earlier. Henry Moore, the sculptor, and absolutely razor sharp, but the use of light and dark is quite pronounced there and really sort of comes out. I photographed my father about that time. Again, the use of light and dark, German actress called Hildegard Neff. Wouldn't be published nowadays because she's smoking. Tyrone Parr, again, light and dark, really sort of paints the picture. Geraldine McEwan, Miss Marple of today, she got a leading role in the West End at the age of 16, and there we have a picture of her jumping with excitement in her bedroom. And that was done with what was then the cutting edge of technology, the stroboscopic flash. In fact, you can see it going off in the thing at the back there. Because everything is completely and utterly stopped on it. Which, of course, was the electric thing of the late 40s, early 50s. Significant picture there, and I like the form of that picture. Again, it's the use of light and dark. Fox Hunter, Colonel Harry Llewellyn, won gold for Britain in the Olympics in 1952 in Helsinki. And they were all the rage for show jumping. And here you have Harry Llewellyn on Fox Hunter, just at the point of going over. Now he's still got his feet on the ground. He's on his neck. And there's the people silhouetted between Fox Hunter's legs. I think that's a super picture in form. There's a bit of one for an age gone by. Farnborough, late 40s. Some interesting trains there when you look at them. Long since gone, well, there are some still flying for the Royal Air Force, like the Canberra bomber. This is probably one of his, in my book, one of his best light and dark photographs. It's a rustabout, American rustabout on the Venezuelan oil fields. 1949. You've got peak partly highlighted, one eyebrow highlighted. A little bit of light, dark, but you can count every whisker on his face. It's absolutely amazing.
He didn't really particularly talk about anything like this. It was so matter of fact. It just was.
That's right. And he would come home. He would come home at the end of the day with a load of contact pictures, maybe one or two about enlargements, and they'd sit on my kitchen table for a while, and my mother would kick them out after a while, make room for having something to eat, and that would, you know, fine. He did a big story on Scotland Yard, I think it was 51-52. We have a whole wodge of photographs. But again, the use of light and dark. You have the guy in the cell silhouetted against the white tiles. And there you have the That's in soft focus, but in sharp focus you have the keys standing out against the white tiles, and you look, you can see every vein on that bloke's hand if you really get into it. As the 50s moved on, so the pictorial magazines like Illustrated and Picture Post folded in on the onslaught from television, which was not as instant as today, but instant compared with what they could do. And they all subsequently folded with time. My father moved, Illustrated went first, he then moved to one that was called John Bull, which was another Odham's publication, where they did a bit more photography and still continued the story. It remained a story magazine, and they sort of did a bit and a bit. And then he went, that folded, and then he went on to working for Woman and Woman's Realm, and did a lot of photographs as a staff photographer, and then became self-employed, mainly working for them, but a lot of other people, and did, if I say things like industrial photography, you look at that, it's very critically photographed, absolutely sharp, and quite dramatic in, again, the use of light and dark on the detail for attention. And there's a lovely picture there, again the drama of the bell ringers after the war. Just look at the clothes they're wearing and the concentration on their faces as they pull the bell ropes. It's very much the same today, of course, but it's and that is also what we've got with us. We do have at home those things that we get out to show our American guests, like my father brought back from Hitler's bunker, some forks that were burnt and stained black and lying on the floor with the AH on the back. We have three left. He brought six home. We used them as kitchen forks after the war. And that's that sort of says, we got some forks. We lost ours when our house was bombed. Well, we used Hitler's, which my mother never liked us to have an egg because they're solid silver. And, of course, egg and silver, you get a nice chemical reaction. And we used to go black, and she used to moan about Hitler's forks. And we have a big 1 litre soup tureen saying household AH on the back. And we have a tablecloth that came out of Hitler's bunker, which and we were lucky to get those. We still got them. Other things that came back, I mentioned one to Linda, which she hadn't heard me say. Obviously the guys in the AFPU, whatever unit he was in, I know not what. I know my father told me stories of walking around the Raleigh factory and almost crying, walking over all these beautiful lenses, just sort of place had been bombed and devastated. And there was all this kit lying ruined on the floor, which for a photographer must be very hard. And they were checked as they came home that they weren't bringing, in inverted commas, contraband home. But this group, and as I say, I don't know what the group was, but obviously my father was involved in part of it. I think Peter Hanford was another one involved with it. They managed to obtain a full-size cinema projector with sound and everything. And it was brought home in pieces, everybody bringing a different bit home, and was reassembled in our hall. And every so often we will get a phone call or a knock on the door and somebody will pass that and another bit will be put on. Obviously it was sold and shared off. But it was, I got a feeling that it went into one of the big London cinemas because it was the latest Zeiss cinema, you know, all singing, dancing, which was better than we had in our somewhat battered industry. Some of the questions that Hilary sort of written there, if we sort of go through some of them,